Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Jawanza for Life. I'm very, very excited to be back with you again this Tuesday afternoon. Well, it's afternoon here in Richmond, wherever you are. It's great that you could tune in and be a part of this show. I am very, very, very excited. It's been a long-awaited show. If you've been following Jawanza for Life, you know that monthly we have we're doing a series. We have a series that we're in the middle of. And we're talking about the 11 laws of God. Some of you may ask, well, what are the 11 laws of God? Well, tonight you're going to find out what the 11 laws of God are. My special guest is Paramount King of the Osaraset Society in Washington, D.C., and he's written an awesome book himself. It's called African Names, The Ancient Egyptian Keys to Unlocking Your Power and Destiny. Our special guest is Orwahehi Metura in Comet. He's been a member of the Osaraset Society since 1975. He was appointed Orwa, which is Paramount King, by Shechem Meshechem Ra'un Nefer Amen, chief priest and king of the Osaraset Society, and he's responsible for guiding the lives of Osaraset's members in the society's activities in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's a member of the society's Harry Care Priesthood and headed Osaraset's African Support Project. He holds a bachelor's degree in African American Studies and a master's degree in education, both from Howard University. He has named and supervised the namings of hundreds of men, women, and children using the process described in his book. Now, without further ado, Brother Orwa, welcome back to Jawanza for Life. It's great to have you back.
That's up. It's good to be back. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. Thank you. Wow, Brother Orwa, again, this has been a long-awaited show. I've had people asking me about you, wondering, when is he coming back on? When is he coming back on? And so for those who've been anxiously awaiting like I have, well, he's back. So you can get on the phone and call somebody and tell them to tune in because the series on the 11 Laws of God is about to continue this week, or this month's faculty that we will be discussing is the faculty of Sebek. That's S-E-B-E-K, the law of Sebek. But before we get into that specific law, for those who might be tuning in for the first time and all of this information is new to them, Brother Orwa, could you please give a brief background to the 11 laws of God? What are the 11 laws of God?
Okay, well, in essence, according to our ancestors, when the Supreme Being created the world, the first thing that it brought into manifestation was the law. And he used the law as the foundation upon which, or the rock upon which, it stood in order to bring the rest of what we know as creation into being. And as above, so below. So if God stands on the law as the foundation, as the rock upon which it operates, then so too must man stand on the law as the foundation or the rock upon which we operate. And so the 11 laws are the faculties within our spirit that we need to cultivate in order to achieve the fullness of our destiny, which is to become a divine being. Now, we've been discussing about 8 of the laws so far. We're about to go into the 9th law, But just to summarize, the first law is the law, the essential nature of our spirit, which is Amen, which in essence says that peace is our essential nature, that everything that we come in contact with, every experience we have, the only natural response we should have to that experience is one of peace. Now, the next three laws make up what we call the Ba part of the spirit, or the divine part of the spirit. So these next three laws are the laws through which our omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence operate. So these are the laws that give us the divine response to the peace that is our nature to every situation. The first of which is out there, which essentially says that there's nothing that's against me. Everything is one. And as such, since there's nothing against me, then I can't have any opposition. So the law of Tehuti says, well, if there's no opposition, but there are things which aren't in accord, then I must have a way of reconciling this apparent difference to bring about the oneness or the unity that Osir is reflective of.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth law, which is Seker, says that, or the third law of the divine triad, fourth law in all, says that we have the power to make real whatever is in sync with our destiny. That as long as we, and whatever it is what we're trying to do, as long as it is in harmony with what we should be doing or need to do, then we come into the world with a spirit that has the ability to make it real. So we move from there into the second triad, or the second three group of three laws that compose our spirit. So our ancestors identified that there are seven different levels to the spirit. So we talked about the first three, which are the divine parts of the spirit. Now the next three make up what we call the transitional part of the spirit, or it's the part of the spirit which separates earth from heaven, or it's the transitional piece. And so that fourth law, which is the law of Ma'at, says in essence that God needs me to come into the world. Therefore, fulfilling that need is the highest expression of love. So true love then is giving, seeking nothing in return. Giving because it is a requirement of the circumstance that I perform this sacrifice or this giving or this love. So the fifth law, which is justice, or Herod Kahuti, says that if there's going to be justice in the world, I have to bring justice to the world. That it is my responsibility to be just. And by doing so, I sow the seed for justice as the result of my just being just.
Mm-hmm.
And the sixth law says that, or the seventh law, and actually says that my will is free. I have my anything and every opportunity I have in life, I have the freedom to choose to do the right thing. I have the freedom to live according to what's righteous or correct, or the law, which is categorized by the principle of Ma'at. So Heru, which is the seventh law, says that, yes, I'm going to be challenged by circumstances. And my true divinity will only be manifested when I choose to do that which is in harmony with my divine nature, when I choose to do the right thing, the correct thing, when I choose to respond in a just manner, when I choose to respond with true love, when I choose to respond with the understanding that my power needs to be in sync with my destiny, when I choose to reconcile whatever the challenge is or the difference is, the apparent difference is, reconcile that oneness, when I choose to let peace be the foundation of my response. So those are the first seven laws. The last month we talked about Heru. Now we're moving into the third triad, or the fourth fifth vision of the Spirit. And in essence, this division of the Spirit is the vision of the Spirit through which we begin to program the functions of the Spirit. So we come into the world. We have these 11 laws, these 11 faculties within us. But we have to learn to use them. We have to learn to program them so that they are the natural response we give whenever we're confronted with a situation. So the programming tools are a part of what takes place with the eighth, the ninth, which is seventh, we're going to talk about the ninth, and the tenth. So the eighth law, which is our imagination or the law of Heteru, says that for me to manifest my divinity, for me to experience the peace that is my true nature, I have to enjoy that peace. We all come to earth to enjoy life. The problem is we believe that the enjoyment that we're supposed to have is the enjoyment of things that we come in contact with. So what the eighth law says to us is, no, the true joy is the joy of reconciling and realizing our divinity. The true joy is understanding that I enjoy the peace. When I enjoy things, when I have them, and when I don't have things, then I enjoy the peace that I have when the things are no longer there. Mm-hmm. The problem in life is that we've been taught that happiness is linked to things. So we get all excited and feel good, et cetera, when we have something. But then when we lose it, then we go into the opposite pole. We get depressed, sad, melancholy, et cetera. Well, that's a violation of our essential nature, which is one of peace. So true happiness is the understanding that peace is my true nature and that I always have peace. I can always choose. That's that seventh law, that rule. I can always choose peace to be, as my response to any circumstance. And so Chedaru, or the eighth law, is the faculty of the imagination that we use then in order to visualize the enjoyment of the divinity itself, as opposed to letting joy be the result of an experience. We understand that joy is the motor for accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Which is to say that, think about this way. Everyone who's listening has things that they enjoy doing. Now, they also have things that they enjoy so much that there are other people who would probably look upon them as being a bit excessive with their joy in engaging in that thing. No one has to convince you to do something that you truly enjoy doing.
True.
If I really enjoy something, you ain't got to come. My parent doesn't have to come to me and say, go study mathematics. If I really enjoy math, I'm carrying around the book all the time studying mathematics. If I truly enjoy music or dancing or whatever it is, no one has to convince you to go and participate in that event. But that's not what true joy is. True joy is the motor that we use to move us to participate in an event. If I already enjoy something, then I'm not experiencing true joy. I'm just, or the enjoyment of the thing, I'm just experiencing joy of the thing. So when the thing is gone again, then my joy is gone. If someone enjoys exercise and they're buried out in the woods in a place where there's no room for movement inside, and there's a 7-foot avalanche covering up the place where they can't go anyplace. Mm. They're going to go crazy because they can't exercise. But if I don't enjoy exercise, I can use my imagination and visualize my person exercising, which will cultivate the response within my spirit such that I will begin to enjoy the act of exercise. Because to the spirit, once you're visualizing something, you're actually experiencing it. You're actually doing it. And they've done all kinds of tests, all kinds of experiments. Many athletes use this as a means of perfecting their skill, perfecting their game, where they'll sit and visualize themselves, the person's doing, performing the perfect game, hitting every ball back if it's tennis, making every shot if it's a foul, if it's basketball. And by constantly visualizing, seeing my person doing this, what I'm telling to my spirit is that I can do this. And that not only I can do it, but I enjoy doing it. Because I see my person enjoying doing it. So this is how I cultivate joy for something that I didn't have a natural joy for. So this is the tool, we say it's the tools in terms of development of the spirit, cultivating the spirit. That's what we mean by the imagination, the visualization, the head of it. So now, Sebek. Sebek has the same approach to changing or cultivating a habit or practice, but it's not through imagination, it's through affirmation. Meaning, I have to convince myself that so-and-so is true about me. And if it is, in fact, in sync with my destiny, then I will experience the realization of that affirmation. Now, see, this is why and how these things are low on the tree, so to speak. Not so to speak. These things are low on the tree because they only work to a limited degree because they're linked to your destiny. If you are not destined to do something, if it's not a part of your divine DNA, no matter how much you visualize your person doing, no matter how much you tell your person that you're going to do it, that you can do it, how much you believe you can do it, you're going to have marginal success because you're working against the stream of your energy.
Okay.
So using right ideas, belief, conviction is important, it's valuable, it's necessary, but it also has limitations. It has to be linked with the truth of my being. If I, as a human being, tell myself that I can do this, then at some point it's going to fall apart because I believe I can do it as a human being. And we know that human beings are limited. But if I tap into my divine spirit, my divine psyche, and I'm reflecting and cultivating those higher laws of my being, and I understand that this thing that I seek to do is in sync with my destiny, then the fourth law says that as long as it's in sync with my destiny, and I put my emotions and images to work at it, then I can make it happen. The third law says that whatever the challenges are, whatever the reconciliation of obstacles, so-called obstacles there are, they can be resolved. The first law says that I am one with this thing. So by identifying with the divine part of my being, I set myself up to allow these faculties, these tools, to function efficiently toward reprogramming my thought and my thinking, which is what Sebek deals with, my thinking about something, and my images about something, which is what Heru deals with. So, and beliefs are a powerful tool, and they're oftentimes minimized. But think about it. There are people dying right now all over this world because of their beliefs. Their beliefs or the beliefs of somebody else. Not necessarily that it's true or accurate, but just because somebody else believes it or they believe it. People have been dying since the beginning of recorded history based on beliefs. False beliefs. But what our ancestors told us was if my belief is not in sync with what's true, if my belief is not in sync with what's my destiny, then my belief is going to lead me down a shortfall, a blind alley. I'm going to have shortfalls. The way is going to be closed. You made reference earlier to said that as the faculty that is on opens the way. When we say about opening the way, what we're saying is that if my ideas are correct, if my beliefs are correct, if they're in sync with what's true, then the way will be open or is open to me being successful for the accomplishment of that goal or that situation, whatever it is. But if I have the wrong ideas, the wrong beliefs, if I affirm the wrong thing, or if the affirmation of the thing is not in sync with my destiny, then I'm going to have marginal or limited or no success in accomplishing that thing. So what we believe is powerful. There are tools. I mean, they've done experiments both with the visualization and the affirmations to show the power of belief. They've done experiments, for example, where a person was hypnotized and told that they were drinking vodka. But in reality, they were drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
And when they brought the person out of the trance, the person was drunk because they believed that they were drinking vodka. Now you could say, well, they just psyched themselves into believing that they were drunk. They drew the person's blood, and the person had an alcohol content in their blood. And now what would be there had they been drinking alcohol. Then they flipped that script, and they told the person they were drinking water. They put them again into a hypnotic trance, told them they were drinking water, when in reality they were drinking vodka. And when they brought the person out, the person was completely sober, and there was no alcohol in their blood. So beliefs are powerful tools. But the critical point of the 11 laws, this law is that my belief must be in sync with what is true, is true about me, what's my destiny. And if that's the case, then I will be successful in my accomplishment. Now, our ancestors, in order to drive this image home, you know, they have these, they use symbols to communicate. You know, the old saying, one picture is worth a thousand words, right?
Yeah.
So the symbol for this faculty, the intellect, is one of them is the dog. Because, you know, dogs are very great animals in terms of their response to hearing. You know, they can think how many thousands of words that dogs can understand, commands, human commands, et cetera. Another symbol are eight, again, because, you know, it's of the mimicry, the so-called intelligence, in terms of applying imaging, responding to imaging in the environment. But another symbol is the crocodile. Now, the crocodile is a very ferocious beast. It will eat you up if you get in the Nile River. But
yes, it will.
In order to control the crocodile, and our ancestors were they used the crocodile to protect their country from invasion, where they would feed the crocodiles on the opposite side of the river from where the people lived. So the crocodiles got used to eating over there. So when the enemy came in, tried to cross the Nile to come over to where the people were, then the first thing they'd have to address would be the crocodile. But there's another symbol meaning to this crocodile image. There's a bird called the ibis bird. And the ibis bird is the bird which is a symbol for Tehuti, or divine knowledge, or truth. And the ibis bird is a little scrawny bird, long legs, similar to like a flamingo, that kind of structure. Long legs, etc. right? And it stands on in the valley, in the water, right, in the Nile, on one leg, motionless. Now, there's a lot of imagery and symbolism that goes into this picture, but there's another fact, a scientific fact, that links back to the connection of Tehuti knowledge, divine knowledge, with Sebek, verbal thought, the crocodile. Because what science has shown is that this ibis bird is responsible for controlling the crocodile population. So now you're thinking, well, wait a minute. How is this little scrawny bird going to control the crocodile population? The crocodile with one small swipe of his tail would break the thing in all kinds of pieces. And if it ever just chopped on it, it would be no more than a real appetizer for a true meal.
True.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the ibis bird does control the crocodile population because the ibis bird feeds on baby crocodiles.
Hmm.
So the symbolism here is that wisdom or truth must control ideas and beliefs.
Uh-huh.
There's another image that was very powerful in Kemet to make this link. Tehuti had this pet, which was part crocodile and part ape, and it kept it on its leash. And so the imagery there is that wisdom and truth must keep thoughts and beliefs on a leash. Because if you don't have an animal on a leash, then it's going to run wild and do what it ever does. So a leash is a way of controlling, making sure that this thing doesn't get out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
So what we think, the beliefs we have, if they're not in sync with what's true, what's correct, if they're not in sync with wisdom, they will cause problems in the world for us, and our way will be closed towards success in life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's look at it from another perspective. If I say that I believe something is true, in essence, what I'm saying is I don't know.
True.
Anytime someone says, I believe, what they're saying is I don't know. And if I don't know and I'm following my belief, then I'm going to have some trouble because sometimes I may guess it right. Sometimes, many times, I'm going to guess it wrong. And as we said, there are all kinds of people lying on Booth Hill now because of somebody's wrong belief.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, not the question, the solution is, to this law, is that I have to keep my ideas, make sure that whatever I'm thinking, whatever my ideas, whatever my beliefs are, I have to make sure they're linked with truth. Once they've passed that test, then I can put them into my spirit. I can affirm them and move forward with whatever it is I'm trying to do. But if I don't protect and make sure that my ideas and my beliefs are in sync with God's will, then I'm going to have problems in my life. Another symbolism of Sebek is Sebek was referred to as the messenger of the Supreme Being, which means that the messenger is the one who gives us the ability to hear, understand what is the law, what's the message. It's the ability to take the law, take reality, and convert it into verbiage, into sentence structure. That enables me to then articulate it and understand it from that faculty. But the intellect is not the same as wisdom. Sebek is the intellect. Tehuti is wisdom. All of the problems that the world has, and I'm not off base probably when I say this. Let's just back off. They say you should never say everything. 99.44% of the problems that the world has are caused because of the intellect of man. Think about it. Think about whatever the problem is that you know. is because somebody thought or believed that this thing was correct. Somebody thought or believed that this was the way to approach something. Somebody thought or believed, and we're not talking about people who just don't have the capacity to think and believe. We're talking about the people of great intelligence. The people who make decisions for the planet are all well-trained people, all highly educated people.
Mm-hmm.
But what is not reconciled is the fact that, and in logic they say, it may be logical, but it's not necessarily true.
Good point.
So things are made with this logical faculty, this sebic faculty. They're reasoned out, quote-unquote, I'm using it in quotes, through the logic of the sebic faculty, and come up with the intelligent response to a situation. But that intelligent response, if it's not true, will only cause a problem further down the road. And we're living the experience of that all over this planet right now. I mean, we can take some old historical stuff, right? They knew very well that in order to cut down on the pests in the field, all you had to do was put DDT on it. Worked in the lab, killed all the bugs, plants thrived, but then they found out later that people and everybody else started dying from the DDT. Well, you know, women are sick from morning sickness, so they came up with this drug back in the 50s, the thalidomide, to stop morning sickness, and it worked. But then babies started being born without arms and legs and all kinds of deformities. So, you know, it works in the test tube. It makes sense. It's logical, but it's not connected with what's true. It's not wisdom being expressed. So when the wisdom, when the faculty, the intellectual faculty, is not leashed to wisdom, when it's not connected to truth, then, yeah, there's going to be some result, and it may make sense for a minute, but ultimately it's going to cause a problem. So that's the true message of this faculty, that we should only affirm the beliefs and ideas that we have that we have confirmed to be true. And by doing so, then we can communicate to our spirit this reality, so that the spirit now will be programmed to experience and express the truth of that belief or that knowledge.
You know, Brother Orwa, even as we're speaking and we're, you know, discussing the law of Sebek, and we're talking about affirmations and affirming, one of the, and we may have touched on it before, one of the affirmations that is, well, one of the false affirmations that is used constantly that helps man to either become divine or not, or hinders, shall I say, that evolution, is the affirmation that I'm only human. You know, we get upset, you know, we blame it on our humanity. I'm only human. You know, what do you expect? You know, hey, I miss it sometimes. I'm only human. Sometimes I lose my cool. You know, I'm only human. You know, of course I was jealous. I'm only human. You know, of course I was enraged. I'm only human. You know, of course I, you know, blew my fuse. I'm only human. And in the earlier part of this discussion, you made reference, as you were speaking, to my person, you know, which is a clear designation or distinguishing between your person and who you actually are. So if you could, just for the listeners, again, we're talking about the law of Sebek, if you're just tuning in, just the affirmation we're talking about, when someone says, I'm only human, and then going back to you making reference to your person, there's a clear distinction there. Could you discuss that distinction?
Sure. The fact that I'm saying, if I say, Well, let's go back to reinforce what we said earlier. Success in life, ultimate success, true success, has to be connected with the realization of our true purpose for being on earth, which is to become a divine being. We all come to earth with the same destiny, to become divine. We have different paths that we need to follow, but all of them are geared towards all of us becoming a reflection of the divinity or becoming a divine being on earth. So if I identify with anything other than my divinity, then I am automatically, ipso facto, making myself a failure with regards to my achieving the true purpose of my being. Because there's a difference between being a human being and a divine being. The human being, we know, is fraught with all kinds of frailties and errors and misgivings, etc. You've all seen the commercial where the television falls out of the third-story window, crashes the man's car. The guy goes up and tries to dunk, and the basketball thing falls over and crashes the man's car. You know, the people back up, the tow truck crashing it. There's something about this that's a common, other than the fact that it's an insurance company, an auto insurance company, that runs a commercial. It also, I think there's something subliminal about the belief that happiness is based on your car. But that's probably another discussion we can have later on. But the idea that I'm only human, and then we tell people, then we tell our children that you can be anything you want to be. Well, that's not quite true, because humans have their limitations. It's not true simply because it's not true either. You can be anything that you want to be if it's in sync with your destiny. But that's another part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to identify different levels of self-perception. If I believe that I am animal, as is taught in the school, then I will expect and be all right with the fact that I respond in an animal nature, because I'm an animal, but, you know, that's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
So if I act like an animal, then it's okay, because that's what I am. If I believe that I'm a human being, which is also taught in school, and understanding that humans are not perfect, because no human is perfect, that's the corollary to the idea of being a human, then I can explain away whatever error I make simply
mm-hmm.
because I'm only human, which is not a problem in and of itself. The real problem is that if I believe that, then I have circumscribed my inability to go beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real tragedy. That's the travesty of the message. If I believe that I'm only human and therefore there are things I can do and things I can't do, then I have set myself up with limitations that I will never overcome, because that's the nature of the human being. But if I identify as being with my divine self-image, and I know that God is complete, God is whole, then I realize then, too, that, yeah, I may fall short at doing something, but that doesn't mean I cannot do it, because God has no limitation. So it then gives me the opportunity to go beyond the limitations that I'm experiencing.
Okay.
Now, just think about it. Where would the world be? We know where the world is right now. The world is an expression of humanity. All of the heinous things that take place on this planet are expressions of humanity. The slavery, the drug addictions, the abuse, spousal abuse, child abuse, pastoral abuse, you name it, is all an expression of humanity. So that's not inhuman, that's human behavior.
Right.
We have to appreciate the fact that all of these things, all these problems, all these ill behaviors that are spoken against by the majority of people in society are in fact reflections of humanity. It's human behavior. It's within the realm of human behavior. So that's the world that we live in. And we live in that world because why? Because everyone has accepted the belief that they're only human. So they can't go beyond that circumscribed area that they live in. But what would the world be like? Let's just imagine for a minute. What would the world be like if instead of everyone believing that we're only human, if everyone believes that we're divine beings in our essence? Sure, people would still fall short.
Mm-hmm.
But we would be striving for more than what we have. People would not accept the fact that abuse is okay because I can't do anything about it, or drug addiction, or whatever the situation is. Slavery could never pass through. And there's also, and there's not just the chattel slavery of the past, but you know, the enslavement of people that takes place today. Africans and non-Africans, child slavery, women's slavery. I mean, there's all kinds of man's, quote-unquote, humanity to man. It's not man's inhumanity to man. It's man's humanity to man.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is man's divinity to man. Because as a divine being, those behaviors are not accepted. I can't accept the fact that I do this simply because I'm human. Because if I'm not human, if I'm divine, then I know that there's something beyond where I currently am that I need to strive for, that I need to reach for, that I need to plan for, that I need to program my spirit to manifest. So that's what the essential message is of this whole dialogue we're having relative to the 11 laws. We have the ability, we have the faculties within us to transform our response to circumstances and situations in our lives, which means that by doing so, we actually are transforming not just our lives, but the world in which we live. So if each of us cultivates, awakens, develops these laws within us, we can turn this world around overnight because the things that are acceptable in the human realm are not acceptable in the divine realm. The things that I believe to be okay in the human realm are not acceptable or believed to be okay in the divine realm.
You know, Brother Orwai, you use the word transform. And, you know, as we transform, my understanding is that we will transcend, you know. And I was actually speaking with someone, and it was about this show actually coming on and a lot of the things that have been happening in the news. And the individual asked me if I was going to have a guest on to actually discuss, you know, what's been going on in the news with the, you know, the whole police brutality and the whole Michael Brown situation. And I mentioned to them that I had, that you were coming on today, and that Brother Orwai could bring a spiritual perspective to this whole discussion. How would you tie in just what's happening in the world today, or specifically with the Michael Brown case, the whole police brutality, with the identifying with the human versus divine, and transforming our thought process from that of being a human to a divine being, and how that ties in to what's happening specifically with that particular situation.
Well, that's a long discussion. There's a lot of moving parts in that discussion. Mm-hmm. I really wouldn't want to minimize it on short notice. Let's essentially say this, though. Let's assume, and it has not been proven to be true, but let's assume that it is true, that the motive behind the man shooting is racist. If that is, in fact, the motive, then what is racism? Racism is the belief, is based on a false set of beliefs that one race is privileged, superior, however you want to define it, to another. And as such, has the right to control the movements, the activities, the destiny of another. Now, that belief is in violation of so many laws that we could take a whole program just dealing with that concept. Mm-hmm. But the approach that we would need to apply to that, though, would have to center on the fact that racism is, in essence, a manifestation of humanity.
Right.
So it's a reflection of humanity. So it's a reflection that the pool that nourishes humanity is contaminated. You know, we use the example of a pond. If you go to a pond and people start fishing in that pond and they pull fish out of the pond and they eat the fish, and every now and then somebody gets sick, well, you would say maybe there's something wrong with the individual. But if everyone who fishes in that pond pulls fish out and eats it and everyone gets sick, then we have to say that the environment itself is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the human experience is toxic, and that all of us are being nourished by this toxic environment. And the only way to clean up the environment is to clean up our view, our approach, our understanding of who we are within the environment. It's nothing more than a manifestation of humanity that someone would shoot someone. It's like this. I mean, there's so many examples. It's sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the young man who got shot in Walmart and killed because he was in Walmart buying a gun that Walmart sold that wasn't even a real gun. And somebody was afraid of a black person walking around with a gun, calls the police. The police come in and shoot the man. The man says it's a toy gun, and the police kill the man. What does that say about society? It says that this fear, these emotions, this polluted environment that racism has nurtured, that this society has nurtured, is killing all of us. Those who believe that they are empowered by it and those who become the victims of it. We're all sick. We're all being fed by the same toxic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution then is for us to transform the environment. We have to clean up the pond. And the only way to clean it up is to get rid of the wrong ideas that fed it. Get rid of the bacteria, the wrong bacteria, the wrong viruses that feed the pond, and which is unfortunately is reinforced by everything within the society. So it's the educational system, it's the religious system, all the systems that are put forth in institutions that nurture this society, feed this toxic environment in one level or another, if they enforce or reinforce the idea that we are human beings.
Well spoken, my brother. By the way, to the listeners online, if you have a question or Wahehe Meturan comment, please press 1 and we'll bring you on. Well, brother, according to the comedic perspective, because according to man's perspective, success in life is, you know, you have the great job, the great wife, the, you know, the great children, you know, you're making a lot of money, you know, and you retire and you, you know, kick back and, you know, ride off into the sunset, sail off on the waters of ease. But according to the comedic perspective, not that you can't have those things, but according to the comedic perspective, what is success?
Well, there's a symbol, which will bring us back to Sebek.
Mm-hmm.
In the comedic scriptures, and you've seen the images that have been taken off of the walls in those in the pyramids in Kemet, of the initiate being led through the hall of justice. And Sebek is the guide. So Sebek guides the person through the halls, so that they can be judged. And one of the major judgments that a person has to pass through is the weighing of the heart. And the weighing of the heart is symbolized by the part of the individual being put on a scale, counterbalanced with a feather, the feather of Ma'at. And the feather of Ma'at is standing erect on its quill. So this is a geometric and impracticality that you would be able to put a feather on a scale and balance it such that it stands upright on its quill. But the symbolism there is that in order for us to be what we need to be on earth, to become the divine being, we have to live an upright life, which is reflected in the fact that our heart is as light as a feather, meaning we have not allowed our emotions, our sensations, to dictate what the choices that we make. Our choices were made on truth. The feather is a symbol of truth. The feather is a non-imposing item. No one is going to force you to do something if what they're holding over you is a feather. You know, no one's going to come up to you and say, bark like a dog or I'm going to beat you with this feather. If you choose to bark like a dog, it's not because you were emotionally or sensually responsive to the feather, unless you're just very ticklish, maybe. The fact that this feather, if you choose to do this, it's because you made the choice. So the symbolism here is that our emotions, our passions, the things of the earth that move us. We talked earlier about the joy of having this thing or that thing. If those are the things that move us, then our heart is going to be heavy. It's going to be weighted. It's going to be embedded with the passion and emotion, which is going to not allow it to be as light as the feather. But if I do what's right, if I do the correct thing, if I live truth, and each and every time I have to make a choice, if my choice is connected and linked to truth, if I freely choose to do this because I know it's the right thing, then I am at that point living as a divine being. And at the end of my life, then I will have lived and become a divine being on earth. So that's the goal of life from the comedic perspective. Yes, we have things, and we should enjoy the things that we have. But the true reality is that the things are not here for our enjoyment. We're here to enjoy the thing, but we're also here to enjoy the fact that when I don't have the thing, I have the peace, which is my essential nature.
Mm-hmm. Brother Oroa, we have a question. Somebody wants to speak to you. Okay. Caller, you're on the air with Orwahehi Meturan Comet. Welcome to Juwanza for Life.
Thank you. Good evening. In the Christian community, the mindset is God the Father alone is holy. perfect and set apart. And we as Christians are in pursuit and in quest of that holiness. It's a continual journey. So my question is that the same as the divinity you're speaking of, and can it ever be attained?
Well, in Christianity, you have God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Right. So that triad was actually
right.
taken from ancient Kemet, where we had
right.
God the Father, God the Mother, and God the Son.
Well, I'm so glad you said that. Go ahead.
And so Osir was the symbol of the Godhead, or the Father God, so to speak. And there are hundreds of records still in existence. There are, you know, we don't know how many thousands of records were destroyed through the burnings and the pillage of ancient Kemet, et cetera. But we do know that there are hundreds of records still in existence where individuals of all walks of life were proclaimed by their contemporaries to be an Osir upon their death. And to be an Osir upon their death means that these people were said to have overcome sin as a part of their living experience. So the answer to your question is yes, that there is, the goal is for each of us to overcome sin, meaning to become a divine being. And our ancestors left records to show that this is not something that no one can do. This is something that a lot of people have already done.
Renee, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, did you have another question or comment?
No, question answered.
Okay. Thank you, my sister. I appreciate you calling in. It's always great hearing from you.
Okay, I'm out as usual.
Okay, peace and blessings. Brother Orwell, I just want to read the law. I know we have only a couple of minutes left, but the law of Sebek states that it's not what you think or what you affirm, it is who is thinking and affirming. Are you a human or a divine being? And the law of Sebek being deducted from the law of Amen states that if we are essentially unconditioned, yet find ourselves full of conditionings that are marring our lives, we must have the ability to restore our original peaceful state of being. This is why the programming faculty, Sebek, is important. Deducing the law of Sebek from the law of Sekur states that if we have spiritual or emotional power, we must have a way of invoking it. This is the function of our verbal affirmations of beliefs on the lower scale and knowledge on the higher. Now, a lot of people get into, and I'm not knocking it, but, you know, a lot of people get into motivational speaking. You know, we read motivational affirmations daily, you know, and based on what we've heard this evening, that is one way to go about, and the intent, I'm sure, is good, to motivate you, to inspire you. Of course, you would rather read something that inspires you and uplifts you as opposed to reading something that's going to make you feel bad and, you know, depress you. But in the last few moments, could you talk about just that, motivational speaking, and that would be a function of the Sebek sphere. Is that correct? Am I saying that correctly? But just that, or the limitations even associated with motivational speaking, if it's not based on, that's the better way of putting it, if it's not based on or lining up with the other, well, not other, but the 11 laws of God.
Well, the short answer to the question would be that it's in the law of Sebek itself. It says it's not what you affirm or believe or think. It's who is affirming or believing or thinking. So motivational thoughts of affirmations are all important. But unless I identify with the divine part of my being, if I'm identifying as a human being, ultimately it's going to be undone within me.
Mm-hmm.
Because the human part of my being is going to reconcile, disreconcile, I should say, my ability to live up to that affirmation. Because ultimately, the human thing is going to lead to a failure.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm identifying with the divine part of my being, and this affirmation is in sync with my destiny, meaning that the power part of my spirit is working toward the fulfillment of this thought, then as you deduce from the law of Sether, then I can do whatever needs to be done. So, yes, it's important to have uplifting ideas, uplifting thoughts, uplifting statements, etc. But it's important that these statements are geared toward uplifting me to my true identity, my divine self.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, at some point, they're going to fall apart. I'm going to doubt my ability to do it or whatever. Whatever human expression comes in, fear, doubt, lust, jealousy, you name it, it's going to be my undoing in regards to success in that thing. It's analogous to...
Brother Worldwide, if I can...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, if I could squeeze one more in, and that's God told me. In a lot of systems, whether it be, Christianity, Islam, whatever, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever the case is, everybody wants to be able to hear from God. Everybody wants to be able to even affirm that, I'm being led by God in Christianity, by the Holy Spirit and Buddhism, whatever that same correlation would be, Hindu the same. Everybody wants to feel that they heard from God, that God is directing our paths and our steps. And people have said it, God told me to tell you this, or God spoke to me in a dream, or God, is directing me, or, So in to be able to tie this into Sebek, it's not what you affirm or what you think, but who that talking, how is one to determine the voice of God?
Well, that goes back to what you talked about earlier with Sebek being connected to Huti, being on the leash for Tehuti. Tehuti is where God, the voice of God, the omniscient faculty, the wisdom faculty of our being. It's there that God, the will of God, is truly communicated. Now, the fact that someone says, God told me to tell you this, doesn't mean that it did or did. They could very well be right. The problem is that in most situations and circumstances, we don't have a way of verifying exactly where the message is coming from. So our ancestors and people all over the world devised techniques, divination systems that have been well codified and used. And all you have to do is use them a while to understand that they are, in fact, accurate, to give us the ability for God to communicate with us through the symbolism of the system what the message is. And I'm glad you brought that up, because on September the 21st here in D.C. at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, Shechem or Shechem, around there from the first, will be here in Washington doing a lecture and book signing on his most recent book. This is called the Yi Qing practice, or the I Ching practice, which is the Yi Qing is a Chinese divination system that has some 3,000+ year history. We've been using it since day one within the Sanskrit society. So that's over 41 years in society, and it's proven itself to be very reliable, accurate, and a true vehicle for us to understand what is the divinity communicating to us in any given situation in life. And so the Yi Qing practice is Shechem or Shechem taking these 40 years of the experience that we've had with this text and explaining it and showing how it is functional to today's world, how it is functional to our lives today. It's not just a historical text from ancient China. It is a true living, breathing repository of wisdom that each of us can use today to help us channel through the great decisions that we have to make in our lives. So we invite your listeners to come to Washington that day, 4 o'clock Sunday, the 21st of September, to hear the lecture, get an understanding of the system, purchase the book, and begin to apply the book so that when someone comes to you and says, God told me to give you this message, you have a way of verifying the accuracy of the message.
Well, Brother Orr, could you give a phone number for people who want more information on that day and, you know, get that so that they can get directions if they're if they don't know where the workshop is going to be held, they can get all the information they need?
Okay, 202-723-5566. That's 202-723-5566. It's here in Washington, D.C. The address is 6224 3rd Street Northwest, D.C., September 21st, 4 p.m.
Brother Orwell, I want to say thank you so much, my brother. This has truly been, again, it's always an honor when I speak to you. And, again, when you're gone for any length of time, the listeners want to know when is he coming back, you know. So, again, I thank you. You're a busy man, and just by, you know, virtue of the fact that you've been gracious enough to come on to Wanza for Life, I certainly appreciate it. The listeners appreciate it. To all of the listeners, I want to say thank you very, very much. Brother Orr, were there any closing remarks before we part until next?
We just want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to share with your listeners, and we look forward to seeing all of you in the flesh on September 21st.
All right, my brother. Thank you so much again to everybody. That is Orwahehi Metura in Comedy's Paramount King, Sarasota Society in Washington, D.C. It's not every day you get to talk to a king, and he's been fortunate and gracious enough to be honored to have him. Just a few announcements for everybody. Again, if you want to just mark your calendar, Brother Orwell comes on every month, normally on the first Tuesday, if his schedule will allow for that, first Tuesday of every month. First Thursday of every month, we talk to Brother Coy, King Coy Dunstan. He's owner and operator of Secrets of Nature in Washington, D.C. We're talking about holistic health. And every second Tuesday, we talk to Professor Geiger. He's author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 101 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Every second and fourth Thursday of the month, we talk to Mike Perry and Heidi Lindman. We call them the Swamis. They're talking about Swami Jyotirvakyananda and Swami Heidi Abhipandananda. They're talking about Kriya Yoga. And every third Tuesday, we have Dr. Akmal Muakil. He's a Chinese traditional healer, and we speak with him. And we've got a new addition to the Jawanza for Life family, Dr. Ruby Lathan. She's cured herself of thyroid cancer, and she's got an awesome testimony, and she's every fourth Tuesday of the month. So for all of the listeners, I want to say thank you so very much. Tell a friend about the show. I certainly appreciate it. By the way, on this Thursday, you all remember, I'm sorry, this Wednesday, that's tomorrow, you remember Shug Avery from The Color Purple? Well, she's going to be my special guest on Jawanza for Life, so make sure you tell somebody. Shug is coming to town. Okay, she'll be right here, 8 to, that's tomorrow night from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, okay? So, again, Brother Orwell, thank you again, my brother. I'll talk to you soon. And for all of the listeners, thank you so much for your time. I don't take you for granted. I appreciate you, and I love you. Peace.